The question is being raised about something that takes place in the Torah before Matan Torah. That is to say, the brothers, when they tried Yosef. Or did they actually try Yosef? That's a very interesting story on many levels. It's a big question. How could the brothers have been prepared to actually execute Yosef? And on what basis? That's really something to analyze when you take it up in terms of the Chumash, to study the whole area, from a philosophical standpoint, not so much from a technical halachic standpoint. So that's something that we've done. There are tapes on that. The basic question over there is, what led the brothers, what brought the brothers to a situation where they were actually prepared to kill Yosef, who was their brother? What did Yosef do that was so bad that would lead them to that? That's something that you really have to look into. Because on the surface, if you just take a look at the surface explanations, they seem difficult. The jealousy, the fact that he got a coat, the fact that he brought back bad reports, all the things that are being mentioned don't seem to rise to the level where it would lead brothers to want to actually destroy somebody. It's very hard to understand. So to be looked at superficially would leave us wondering about the nature of the brothers. Why would so you don't like somebody. Basically, you don't like him. And then he has dreams. Obviously, there's something much deeper going on over there. I'm just trying to point out now that if you take it at face value and think about what you're learning, as a child, perhaps, it's not a problem. Children have no problem. Because children are more simplistic and you get angry, jealousy, your dreams, snitching, etc. So it's easier for children to understand how brothers would dislike somebody, even to the point where they would want to kill them. But as an adult, if you assume you're dealing with not just ordinary people, but great people, great leaders, so then the question becomes, what was going on over here? You don't find this happening in ordinary families, of ordinary people, even people on a low level. There's a certain feeling for brothers. Not to say that there are cases where somebody will kill his brother, but generally speaking, it was something that really got him emotionally in a state of rage. But that's low-level people. Generally, for the kind of things you're reading about, so why'd they have to kill him? Because the father was favoring him? Because he spoke some Lashon Hara against them? Because he had some dreams, which they debunked altogether? Doesn't add up. That's the challenge. That is the challenge. Although that's not the question that's being addressed right now. I'll just answer that question in a general sense, without going into all the particulars. And there's no doubt in my mind that the brothers were not motivated to want to kill Yosef because of petty considerations, because they couldn't deal with the jealousy, or because he had some dreams, which they themselves frowned upon. They didn't think the dreams were serious. So what? So he had some dreams. So what? Rather, when you think into it, they had concerns that Yosef was a real threat to them, was a danger to them, and that he had delusions of grandeur. He had intentions of taking over. That's what they said as a result of the dream. Hamoloch timloch aleinu? Do you plan to rule over us? Hamashol timshol banu? Are you going to be are you going to rule over us? Are you going to be the king over us? They began to look at Yosef as being someone who was a serious threat, who took himself seriously, who believed that these dreams were prophetic dreams, because that's why he told them over the dreams, and who had one way or another had earned the favoritism of Yaakov, and was hostile to them, was bringing back bad reports about them. You put it all together, they formed a picture of Yosef as being someone who was a very serious threat to them. And if he were allowed to go on with his normal plan, he would have been a big problem. I don't know all the particulars, but he planned to be the leader. He planned to take over the whole movement. And he planned to subjugate them. The dreams indicated subjugation. The bundles bowing down to his bundles. Now, they may have not taken the dream prophetically. Obviously, they did not, but it was clear that Yosef did. So I'm just indicating with this that what took place was deliberation. When they saw Yosef coming to them in the field, and they said, here comes the dreamer. Let's kill him, and we'll see what happens to his dreams. That is to say that there was a process of deliberation by which they arrived at the conclusion that he's a threat, he's a danger, and they have permission to execute him, to do what's necessary. Although, in the end, they finally agreed to the plan of Yehuda, not to execute him. So now the question is being raised, if we say that this was not just acting out of emotions, and this was a serious consideration, even though the Torah doesn't describe it step by step, it's not the derech of the Torah to describe it step by step, but they went through a process of deliberation, and they came to the conclusion that he was chayav misa, that he was deserving of death. What legal mechanism, what right did they have to do this? Under what kind of a power were they acting? Specifically, the question is being raised, if they were acting in the framework of being a Sanhedrin, which according to Jewish law has the right to try cases, they weren't even 23. The way I would answer that question is that all of these requirements in terms of Beis Din, and you need 23 for Sanhedrin, and under what conditions can you judge capital cases, that's after the Torah was given. So they were operating with a system, but this is before the Torah was given. And it was a completely different framework. Even Yosef did not even have the status of being a Jew, as we know it today. It wasn't, I don't think he was merely an Ochid. He was part of the family, which was destined to become Klal Yisrael. But all I could say is that in general terms, they operated as some kind of a court. They had the responsibility. They represented the leaders of the next generation, and they thought it through. They made deliberations, and they came to a conclusion. And in the pre-Sinai situation, they were convinced that they were doing the right thing. Of course, they were making a mistake, and that came out later. But what exactly the halachic, so to speak, considerations were is not a problem because we can't compare what we have now after the Torah was given. Nitna Torah v'nischat shalacha. Once the Torah was given, the law was created anew, so to speak. Even though there are certain things in the Torah that go back that existed before, like circumcision, nevertheless, we derive our obligation not from Avraham Avinu, but we derive it from Sinai. And then, of course, many institutions that didn't exist. So what mechanisms were used to arbitrate, to settle disputes, and even to give capital punishment, whatever they were different than what we have after Sinai? That's the answer to that question. The question is being raised, what compels me to defend the brothers up to that point? That is to say that, I'm not saying that what they were doing was just. It turns out, in point of fact, that they were wrong. And that's the reason why Yosef subjected them to that kind of treatment, the harsh treatment, which ultimately led to their doing tshuva. I'm not saying that what they did was just. I'm saying, however, that they were operating within their own framework of justice. They weren't just acting out their emotions. That there was deliberation, and they made a decision. And they made a mistake in that decision. What compels me to say that is my understanding of the nature of the people that we're dealing with. That these are the children of Yaakov, the sons of Yaakov, and our Masora regards them all as being great people, as being tzaddikim. And they went on to become the leaders of Klal Yisrael. At the end, Yaakov blesses them. And whoever's included in the blessing is included in the designation that they'll be one of the Shiftei, it's called Shiftei Kah, the tribes of God. These are the Shvatim. So if you can tell me that these people are wicked people, that they were on a very low level, and did not subscribe to any of the rules that were in existence at that time, they weren't servants of God, so how is it possible that they later on became the leaders? They should have been thrown out. As you do find, Yishmael was separated from Yitzhak, and Esav was separated from Yaakov. So my task is to reconcile what they did to Yosef with the basic assumption that you're dealing with people who are not, no one's perfect, but who are tzaddikim. They're all tzaddikim. They're on a very high level. So that's the underlying factor. And the truth of the matter is this. Even if you maintain that they're not people on a high level, which I say is impossible to say that, but even if you were to say that, the story doesn't make any sense at all. Because what it then would be presenting is not just unjust behavior, but such arbitrary behavior that it wouldn't even be normal. It's not normal for brothers to gang up and kill one brother over the types of things that are being described in the story, which seem to be very, very trivial. The question being raised is that why, if indeed they found him guilty and deserving of death, so why didn't they give him the death penalty? As we know now, if Sanhedrin finds somebody guilty, it's a mitzvah saseh, it's a positive command. They have to give him the death penalty. They can't exonerate him. They can't take mercy on him. Again, we're going back into a different situation where they were operating within a framework, but it's not the same framework that we're talking about after the Torah. It's not as though he was being tried for any particular kind of a crime. What was the crime? It's no crime to have dreams. It's no crime to be the favorite. And you may say it's a crime to do Lashon Hara, but you don't get the death penalty for that. So there's no crime. So there was a different kind of a trial. It was based upon the fact that it was clearly a case of preemptive justice. That's what it was. If anything, it would be similar to something like a Ben Sora Omora, the rebellious child, who really doesn't commit any crime that's deserving of the death penalty, but he's growing up like a real delinquent, and he steals money from his father, and he buys him meat and wine, a gluttonous type of behavior, together with a group of fellow delinquents, bums, so to speak. And the Gemara says that he receives a death penalty. Of course, this is the kind of case, again, it's just an illustration. It's a prototype. That the Gemara maintains that there was never such a case. Never was, never will be such a case. It's set up in such a way that it won't happen. But it was established in order to teach us principles, teach us ideas. But the concept behind it was, why is he being killed? He didn't commit any capital offense. So the Gemara says, Al Shem Sofo. The Torah looked into his deeper nature, his psyche, and it realizes that if this continues, he's going to be a murderer. He's being raised on a path which is going to lead to murder, because it's very much similar to many delinquents today, the profile. That he's being raised in a manner which addicted to instinctual gratification, and not developing the skills, the tools, to be able to get by in a constructive kind of a way. So what does that lead to? It leads to thievery, like drugs. Most people that are raised in drugs become killers. One thing leads to another. Because the need is insatiable, and it also destroys the capacity of the person to make a living, to work constructively. It would be bad enough if he's just taking drugs, but he can't support the habit, and he's desperate, he must have it. So what does he do? He goes out and steals. But once you're going out and stealing, there's a slight problem that you bump into. There are other people over there that don't want to give their money away. Or if you do steal from them, they're going to report you to the police. So therefore, once you steal, you have to become a killer. You have to get rid of these people. So basically what we have, that's the portrait of a murderer. He's a murderer in formation. So the Torah is telling you a principle of morality. Yeah, the preemptive strike. Preemptive strike. Better to remove this individual. Of course, this is being stated in the realm of the abstract, because as we said, there is no. It's not going to happen in a specific case. But that, just because it's being stated in the realm of the abstract, doesn't mean it's not very, very important. That is the truth. There are certain truths in the Torah, truths in the Torah, and these truths are not necessarily going to be carried out. Can you think of a different one? In Mishpatim, says that if somebody takes out somebody else's eye, ayin tach azayin, shein tach hashein, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and so on and so forth. And if you just read it literally, if all you had was the literal, so you would think that they operated according to a system of corporal punishment, which in general In most civilized societies today, you don't have that. In primitive societies, you may have that. But we know from the Gemara that it's not the case. It never was the case. That it really means the monetary repayment, the monetary worth of the eye. And the Gemara has a whole system. Because you can raise the question, how is it possible to evaluate the worth of an eye, the price? So the Gemara has it worked out in a practical kind of a way. But the point is that this is not something which was changed. It wasn't that originally they executed this kind of justice, and later on they changed it. Well, if they would have done that, then I think they would have taken out those passages in the, in the Torah, I would imagine. But that's the interpretation. It's written this way. The meaning is monetary. And how do we know this? Because that's the Torah Yishmael Peh, that's the Masorah. That when God taught Moshe the Torah, so he instructed him that this is not literal, but this is monetary. And all the different ways in which it's to be evaluated. But of course the question arises, if that's the case, so why is it written that way? The way it's written conveys a different impression. That it's an eye for an eye, that it's not monetary. Again, the question arises, why is the Torah writing something which is not going to be, or in a sense it's not true? The answer is that it contains a truth. And even though this truth is not going to be manifested in a particular situation, it's important for us to know that truth. And that truth is that from an idealistic standpoint, if a person were to remove somebody else's limb, the ideal punishment would be exactly what he did to somebody else, that should be done to him, measure for measure. That is the perfect punishment. From the standpoint of the abstract. So if that's the case, why isn't it done? Because, practically speaking, it would be too difficult or too painful. Well, whatever the cases are. The decision was that, practically speaking, you come as close as you can through money. So again, it's not just a monetary payment. You shouldn't have the idea that you just can pay for an eye with money. But the money is really an atonement, so to speak. Because really, you're being redeemed. You really deserve to give up your eye. Now, it's important to know that. The Torah is communicating that truth. That if a person commits a crime against someone else, then the absolute justice is that that same thing should happen to him. That you need to know. And the same thing is true in terms of the Ben Sora Umora, the rebellious child. That an individual that is developing along these lines where it's clear the direction that he's headed in is going to be one in which he's going to wind up because of desperation, being a killer, it's better for that person to be executed now before he actually kills. That's the teaching. Preemptive strike, so to speak. Which is better for society and better for that person. Because the person is never given an opportunity to reach that point at which he's a murderer. Even though he has the profile of a murderer, there's a difference between when a person actually carries out and does the crime, as opposed to when he's simply disposed towards it. That model, I would say, is the one that's appropriate to understanding how the brothers looked at Yosef. It wasn't for any particular crime, but they regarded him as being headed on a path which is going to lead him to enslave them and to destroy the whole unit, the family unit, and which was destined to be Klal Yisrael, and so on and so forth. They viewed him as a threat and a danger, and he had to be removed. That was their decision. So, even though it may not have been the right decision, they made a mistake, but I'm trying to show you that they were great men. Great men operate in a certain way. Doesn't mean that they never make mistakes. That's not the case. Everybody. There's not a person in the Torah, there's not a person in existence that doesn't make mistakes. That's being human. But I'm trying to show you that they looked at the situation in a completely different light. The idea that we don't function according to an eye for an eye literally can be characterized as rachamim, if you want, mercy, compassion. But I don't know if you necessarily have to go that far. It's just a matter of reality that the laws of the Torah are perfect. Perfect laws. Perfect has to be from the standpoint of abstract truth. That's one element. But then there's a subjective element. which could be at odds with human nature and what human nature can tolerate. And the effect it's going to have on the individual or the effect it's going to have on society. So it may be that from an ideal standpoint, you're supposed to do X, Y, and Z. But from a practical standpoint, it's going to cause too many problems, too many negatives. So the actual law, the actual hanhaga, so to speak, how you're going to conduct yourself is not always necessarily going to be in accordance with the abstract. Here's a case. From pure abstract justice, it should be literally an eye for an eye. Eye for an eye. But if you take into consideration human nature and human weaknesses and the effects that implementing such a policy would have, Torah said no. But it's still necessary for you to know that point, the truth. I'm not negating with regard to the brothers any of the elements. The jealousy played a role. But it's important to realize it didn't play a role as you understand it when you're a child. That it's a simplistic thing. I'm jealous, I can't take the jealousy, so I beat you up. Something like that. Now, the jealousy had the effect of causing them to be predisposed against Yosef. In and of itself, they would not have hurt him because they were jealous. However, once you're predisposed against a person, then you're going to interpret certain other behaviors, certain negative behaviors, you're going to interpret in a different light. You're not going to give the person the benefit of the doubt. That is to say, that there's a difference in how you treat people, depending upon your emotional attitude towards them. You'll see that. I'm not saying it's correct. You should strive to be as objective as you can. But most people aren't perfect. So that when you are dealing with someone that you like, for example, you'll see the inconsistencies with parents. Parents can be very, very critical of other people's children. This particular, they're not neat, or they weren't respectful, and so on and so forth. But then when somebody points out that your own child did X, Y, and Z, then you see a different attitude. And they're more willing to tolerate it or to rationalize it. You have to know the background. You have to be more sympathetic. You follow? So why aren't you sympathetic with somebody else's child? Well, it's a different attitude. Now, if a person is truly philosophical, is truly just, truly aware, self-aware, you'll apply the same standard, you know, because that's false to have two standards, to look at your own child or your own friends in one way, to defend them and to attack others. That's an injustice. But most people don't reach that level of objectivity. Very rare. Most people don't have that. They don't separate themselves from that emotion. And they don't have that ability to look at themselves and to recognize that what they're saying is really emotions. They want to believe that it's truth. So, the jealousy played a factor. It was a factor. It played a role. And the role was that it predisposed them. Then, when they saw other things, they were more inclined to interpret them towards the negative. We have two possibilities over here. Meaning to say that if they didn't have that emotional jealousy, the other things might have disturbed them, but they would have interpreted it in a different context. So everybody knows what that's like. Once you don't like someone, whatever you hear about that person, you're going to interpret, you see? He's this, he's that. That's the way the mind works. You're going to be opposed. When you like somebody, you're more willing to listen to the rationalizations. Questions being raised, why couldn't they wait if the concern was that he would take over and it was all about the future. Interesting, you do see the preemptive strike. All this was clearly preemptive. Because at that point in time, I don't know that he was posing a threat then. But they kind of had a sense of what he was planning to do in the future. That's true. But the concept over here is that there is such a thing as the preemptive strike. The same thing is true with the Ben Sora Mora, according to the concept. That we don't know all the particulars. In terms of them consulting with Yaakov, obviously they didn't do that, because they considered that Yaakov was prejudice. That's simple, it's clear. He was the one who favored Yosef. It's it was clear to them that he was not being objective. See, when you have these kind of problems and situations, so then you look at the other one as not being objective. So that they couldn't do. And they also, it's a good question, one can, we don't have all the deliberations over here. We just have a result, so it's hard to reconstruct. But to the extent that they might have considered waiting, if that issue arose, they decided against it. And you can understand why. I mean, as time goes by, the situation can get worse. It can get stronger, and so on. There's all kinds of possibilities. I can't go into the particulars because I don't have a record, a transcript of what they actually said. But it's not a problem. They were in that situation, and they decided that they should do it, and that this is the time to do it. Now we have the situation. Also, bear in mind the opportunity factor. That's another interesting aspect to the story, that now they were being presented with an opportunity. That is to say that they were out in the field, and Yosef was sent, and they had an opportunity to have him disappear and make up the alibi, make it appear that he was killed by an animal. That's also significant, because opportunities like that do not always present themselves. But I don't know. I don't know what all the factors were, but the issue of let's wait and see was not an option for them. The point is being made that the more you look into the particulars, that is to say that there were two dreams that showed Yosef as being the leader, but they were different. The first one was with the bundles in the field, bowing down to his bundle. The second one was the brothers depicted as stars and the sun and the moon, that's the parents. So the significance was that in the first dream, the subjugation or the subservience was in the economic sphere, that he would have the economic power over them. But the implication of the second one, when the brothers are being depicted as stars, which illuminate, that depicts the family in terms of the spiritual level. So the second one was perhaps even more significant, because it indicated the first one indicated that he would have the economic power over them. But the second one indicated that he was even more ambitious, that he wanted to rule in terms of the spiritual life, in terms of the system of ideas and philosophy and Torah. So that even made him more of a threat to them. It wasn't just a question of personally being subservient to Yosef. They were not judging Yosef by his unconscious. They had a certain profile of how a person behaves. The vanity, the egotism, the favoritism, and the dreams. It wasn't just that he had the dreams, it was that he told them the dreams, and was trying to make the case that these were prophetic, that this is the will of God. Now, once a person has all these elements, he believes that God is on his side, and he has this desire to be a ruler, there's only two possibilities. Either it's true, which in fact it was. But if you don't believe that it's true, then you have to come to the conclusion that you're dealing with someone who's got a serious problem of megalomania, who's a real danger, who's a real threat. That's the decision that they came to. But it proved to be the wrong one. And the personal factors, the subjective factors of jealousy and so forth, they play a role. They contribute to that. But what I'm trying to show you is that they were just contributory. It wasn't the final cause, so to speak. It wasn't the cause of why they killed them, because they couldn't deal with the jealousy. That's not the case.